They want to talk to you, I think. So you're really just doing this one for fun?
No.
Is it it's not compulsory, is it?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's the way they structure the degree.
Really?
But it's good. You get to hear about logic. This is my fourth and fifth time.
So why are you here? Why not? Gosh. But then they're not necessarily taught in exactly the same way. Usually syntax might be slightly different and stuff, and also some of the emphasis might not be the same, for instance. That's it. You know the semantics. Well, you need. But you see, but the thing is about this course is that we don't care that. We care about semantics in terms of just mentioning it, but then we don't do anything really semantical. It's all purely syntactic, symbol pushing. That's what proof theory is about. What's that? Well, it doesn't fail. It depends what your definition of failure is. Oh, yes. But remember, the Turing test is all about pretending. Oh. Yes, it's not. Chinese room experiment, you know that? Yeah, it's not. So if we know what's going on, you can't tell whether it's intelligent or not, right? You can see, but if you can't actually peer into the process, how do you know? But you're right. Good? Sure? How are you? You're coming to the tutorial next week, right? Yeah, good. That's too low, right? All going to sleep, I won't even know. Right. Should we start? Let's do it. Yeah. Well, where are the other people? No? Sleeping? Doing? They have other things to do. It's Friday after all, right? Obviously. Obviously. These are the ones. Actually, these are the ones I want here. You guys can go because you're not doing your assignment. Yes, right. So we're going to be looking at first the logic a bit today. And like I've been told many times already, so some of you have seen this several times. So, but anyway, it'd be a refresher for some of you, and for others, it'd be just maybe. Who's never done any first order logic? No one. Who doesn't remember anything about first order logic except it's called first order logic? Is that right? That's good. So at least it won't be all for nothing. Right. So at least, you know. So this is from Russell and Novick, 8.1 to 8.3. Ready?
Sure.
All right, let's do it. You can talk. So, why first order logic, first of all? So, what we're going, so, you know, one question is, okay, we've done propositional logic. We can sort of use it even for our Wompus world. But the problem is, right, is that it's not good enough, as you know, because it's not expressive enough. And the idea is why you want to use FOL is because it's going to enable us to express more things in a less verbose way. And you can, it's also more powerful. So we'll be able to do new things that we couldn't do with propositional logic. And by the way, right, for those of you who don't know first order logic, you know, even that is not good enough for many things. So if you want to talk about, you know, if you want, well, we'll see. If you want to talk about even some stuff which does, there are things which don't even fall under, you know, the cannot be captured properly by first order logic. So then you have higher order logic. So you can have second order logic. You can, for instance, the principle of induction is a second order property. Right, and you can have general higher order logic, and these are the kind of things I use, for instance, in my research. Right, so we'll look at the syntax and the semantics of first order logic, right, and just a few examples of this, and then we'll just briefly look at the Wumpus world. So if you've seen first order logic before and you remember, in a way, there's not too much, there won't be much new in this lecture, but still, you need to know about it because to be able to use it with, for instance, when we're doing resolution and stuff. Which you also have seen, you said, right? Anyway, so what are the pros and cons of propositional logic? So let's start like with this, you know, propositional logic is good, right? So it can do a lot of things. There are many domains that can be expressed just propositionally. And one good thing about propositional logic is that it is, forgetting about this, well, is it there? No, one good thing is, I give you a sentence in propositional logic, what can you do? What can you do? Can you? Yeah, you can tell whether it's true or false because you have decision procedures for propositional logic, right? Which is a good thing to have. Unfortunately, a lot of them are not very efficient, right? They can be exponential, the number of propositional letters, like truth table. But you have Davis-Putnam, which can be quite nice, DPLL, right? And there are others like WalkSat and things like that, right? So that's nice. And the other thing is that it's actually declarative. What does this mean? It means that, you know, when you write it as a sentence in propositional logic, it actually you see everything. It's domain independent. You don't need any special data structures or anything like, you know, where you need to necessarily compute, right? It tells you what's going on. If you have P and Q, it means P is true and Q is true. That's all it is, right? So it allows partial disjunctive and negated information, which is unlike most data structures and databases, right, for instance, as well. Right, so it's a declarative language, right? What you see is easy. You don't need to run anything, to do anything special where you need to use some domain knowledge necessarily to figure out what P and Q is, right? But also you can do things such as negation on it, right? Which is something that is quite difficult to do very often. So that's why there is a whole, well, let's not go there. So. But, you know, that's important. But it gives you this kind of power, right? And also it's compositional, right? So you can take two pieces of syntax together and put them together. You can take, you know, B11, P12, whatever it is, you know, two symbols, and then you can get its meaning, or you can get the meaning of this, right, from the meaning of the first, its constituent symbols, right? Right? And so the meaning in propositional logic is context independent, like I said already, which is unlike natural language, right, where meaning depends on context, right? So if I say something and I refer to it, what does it mean in this case, right? Well, there's no such thing if you're talking about propositional logic. It is going to be independent of the context in which you're using it, right? But of course, it has very limited expressive power, unlike English, French, or whatever language you want to talk about, or even first-order logic, right? So for example, we cannot say Pitts cause breezes in adjacent squares, generally in a generic fashion like this, except by writing one sentence for each square, because we have to talk about each square. So if we have a grid with 9, we have to differentiate between grid square 1, 1, square 1, 2, etc. And we have to write this for each of the squares. And if we have a grid which has like 1,000 by 1,000, already this is not very feasible, right? So what we want is to find a way of being able to write this in a more general fashion. And that's what first order logic enables us to do, right? Okay, so but the first one is, so propositional logic is going to assume that the world just contains facts, right? It's either true or not, right? The sky is blue, right? For instance, that's a fact. It's just like one atomic fact. First order logic, like natural language, is going to assume that the world is going to contain objects. So now suddenly we can have things about particular objects in the world, right? So people, houses, numbers, colors, football games, whatever, walls, chairs, students, whatever, computers, whatever, right? So we're going to have these objects, and we can group these in part of domains. And also we're going to have this notion of relations on these objects, right? And, you know, for instance, you can say something is red, right? This chair is red, and that's going to be true or false, right? Round, prime, etc. So we're going to have relations or properties, right? So brother of someone, bigger than, part of, etc., etc. Any relation you can think between two objects can be expressed, right? And we also have the notion of functions that you know, that are going to, you know, you're going to give it an object, it's going to give you another object. So the father of X is going to be Y, for instance. And you have a notion of like, if I give you this particular object, give me, you know, this particular student, for instance, give me his or her best friend, you can say, okay, there is a function that will do that. Maybe not in real life, but there is a notion of a best friend that can be returned in some way or another. Or one more than, et cetera, plus, like the ones we've seen, minus, multiplication, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So what happens then now, suddenly we have this, we have relations and functions, right? And functions we didn't have before. Okay? Well, we didn't have that. So just to give you an example, now, so the basic elements are going to be constants, right? So we can have things such as King John, or the number 2, the University of Edinburgh, that's referring to a particular thing, right? And we have these predicates that we talked about. These are going to be related to the notion of relations, right? Like brother. It can be it's going to be like brother, take an argument, true or false. And greater than, less than, etc. These are relations. They're going to have truth values. And functions are going to be things such as like the square root function, right? Give it a number, it gives it a real number. With floating point, gives you its square root. Or something like multiplication, for instance, can be a function. And something like, you know, give me the left leg of someone for some reason, that's also a function, right? Also, we're going to have what's known as variables, x, y, a, b, whatever. We decide to say, okay, these are the variables. Sometimes, you know, people decide by convention that anything at the beginning of the alphabet is going to denote a constant, anything towards the end of the alphabet is going to denote variables. It doesn't have to be necessarily like that, right? Depends, you know, as long as you make it clear what are your variables or what are your constants, you're fine, okay? And of course, we're going to still have these. We've seen these already. These are just the connectives we had before, right? Negation, implication, et cetera, et cetera. We can also have the notion of equality. So we're going to use this over objects, right? Whether two objects are equal to each other. So, and what's also going to be new are these, the for all and existential quantifiers, right? So this is what is going to give it more power. Well, not just that, but that's going to enable you to talk about, say, all chairs are red, or things like that, right? Or there exists someone who doesn't like this class. I'm sure there's more than one, but you know, you can actually say it. You don't know who it is, but you can say there is someone who doesn't like it. Okay? Any questions? All this is coming back to you? You're saying yes always. Somebody say no. Is this coming back to you? No. Okay, it's good though. So if it's all coming back, that's great. It means like we can go very quickly. And we can all leave here at 3:30. It'll be good, right? So, what about atomic formulae? So, okay, so we have now the notion of formula. What is it that are the formula of first order logic? So we're going to have the notion of predicates being applied to terms, right? But we're going to define terms there, right? So a predicate is something that's going to be applied to a term. So remember, a predicate is something like brother, greater than, et cetera, right? And we can also say it's also this notion of equality. Term one is equal to term two. So in some presentation of first order logic, they don't have this one at all. You know, you don't necessarily have to have this. You can just treat equality just like a normal notion of predicate, right? But or you can make it something which is built in. So we're just going to choose this one, but we're going to have this notion, and equality is going to be treated as a distinguished kind of predicate itself, right? To give us a notion of formula there, right? And what is a term? So we have these terms, these objects. So terms do not take, so these are going to be actually taking Boolean value. They're going to be either true or false, right? They're going to map to true or false. But terms don't. Terms are going to, for instance, map to constants, right? It's either a constant or a variable, right? Or it's a function that's applied to terms. So in a way, yeah, that's not the best way of writing this, actually. So really, I should have put this, probably better to put this like lowercase if I want to really show that it is a recursive, right? So terms, so then it calls, because it can be a function of a function of a function, right? That's also perfectly possible. So really, this should be lowercase there just to make it a bit clearer. I don't know why it's uppercase. So a function can be a function symbol and then a function of a term, for instance, or a function of a function, et cetera, right? So here are particular examples there where we do see that. So here's an example. So this is a predicate there. These are two constants, right? So King John is brother of Richard the Lionheart, right? And here's another one. We could write it like that the length of the left leg of Richard is greater than the length, you know, he's got a longer leg than King John, right? Longer left leg. So what do? We say, okay, we take the length, which is a function, then we have another function as argument that's going to give you the left leg of Richard, right? And Richard itself is a constant in the problem we're looking at. Right? Then we do the same here. So this is a function taking as argument, a function of a constant, right? And this, the predicate there is written there. So as you can see, the way I've written the predicate there is in this form, right? We greater than as a prefix in prefix notation. But usually we tend to write it in infix notation, right? We write this and then we put the greater than. And it's just a convenient notation, infix notation, right? Of course, this, having said that, you know, when it comes to parsing, there are differences. But as far as we're concerned, you know, if I decided not to write it in that way, usually you would write in a more readable fashion like this, right? So you all happy with this? Right. Okay, good. But you do know there are differences in terms of how you do, you know, if you have prefix and postfix and all these kind of things. Okay. Then we can build our more complex formula as before. So once we're happy what a formula is, right, an atomic formula is made of this, we can just build the, you know, more complex one using our notion of negation, conjunction, disjunction, implication, and if and only if, right? So then we can say that King John is a sibling of Richard, right? Implies that Richard is a sibling of King John, right?
You know, they're just siblings. It's just, it doesn't matter. It's a symmetric relation, right? They're brothers.
So then we can start writing things like this. And we can also say that 1 is greater than 2, or 1 is less than or equal to 2, right? We can write this. These are perfectly legal. And we could also write 1 is greater than 2, and it's not the case that 1 is not greater than 2, right? Or could be false. You happy with this? Okay, just like, this is, we're just talking about syntax so far. We're not looking at meaning at all, right? Now we look at meaning. So how do we give semantics to these objects and to everything, to constants and predicate and functions, right? So we need to map the formula to an interpretation. So remember the notion of interpretation for propositional logic. What does it mean, interpretation for propositional logic? It's just a mapping of propositional letters to? To? True? Or? Yeah, that's all it is, right? It's just a mapping. It's the same idea, except we're going to extend it. Yeah, exactly. So don't say it's a mapping to meaning, because you're then giving me a circular answer to my question. I'm saying, you know, what is the meaning? But it's just a mapping. You're just going to say propositional letter is either true or false. But in this case, it's more complicated because you have other things going on, right? So same as before, though, an interpretation is going to be called a model of a set of formula when all the formula are true in the interpretation. So that's identical to what we had for propositional logic. This thing doesn't change at all. Why should it, right? But now is that we need to talk about the relations. So we need to talk about the objects that are contained, right? So the interpretation is going to contain objects. So it's going to have to give a domain. So this is where things change. Before, you only had true or false you could assign to the propositional symbols. Now you need to actually assign a domain. If I tell you, you know, this is a function, this is something like this one, right? Like this. Well, this one's not good actually. So if I say x greater than or equal to y, you need to say, okay, what is x? Right? So this is the domain. Because x greater than or equal to y, x could be a natural number, x could be an integer, x could be a real number, whatever. So that's the first thing you need to give. You need to say, what is the domain I'm looking at? Right? And now the relation between these domains, right? Okay? So the mapping is going to specify the reference for these various things, right? For the constant, the predicate, and the function. And these are the reference. So the constant symbols that I have in my sentence are going to map to actual objects in my domain. So if I have like a constant, I have, you know, A is less than equal to B, and I say A and B are constants, they have to be mapped to actual values in my domain, like 1 or 3 or whatever, right? So they get mapped to the actual objects I'm talking about. And the predicate symbols themselves are going to be mapped to relations, right? So, you know, maybe I've written P of AB, right? So one way of doing this, I'm going to say A gets mapped to 1, B gets mapped to 2, right? And P gets mapped to greater or equal, right, for instance, right? I have to map them on relations on this that exist on this particular domain. And the function symbols just get mapped to actual functions. So the fact that I've written, for instance, something like square root of A, right? I've written it like this, right? So it is quite odd, right? Let's assume I'm telling you this is it, right? If I'm doing the mapping and I tell you that the domain actually is the domain of natural numbers, so then I would decide, okay, I can map this to 2. But you know, the fact that I've written it square root, usually you're going to assume, because what you know, what this is, you're going to say this is the square root. But if I'm telling you in my domain there is no such thing, then maybe square root itself, which is a bit odd, maps to, I don't know, the function that adds 1 to something. right? That's perfectly possible, which is a bit, makes it pretty weird. So the thing that, what I'm trying to say is that the pitfall is when you look at a particular sentence, which is just syntax, and I write it like this, for instance, x plus y is equal to z, the tendency is that you give this meaning already that this is the usual notion of plus, right? But if I write it like that, it doesn't mean, before I do the interpretation, that this plus that I've written there is necessarily plus. Maybe in one, I can tell you, give me an interpretation, for instance. So we all know this, right? So we know this. You'll see in the past exam question there, things like that. You all assume that this is actually always true. But I can ask you to give me an interpretation, right? This is just some syntax there, just a thing there. Give me an interpretation where this is actually not true. This doesn't hold. So then you need to come up with something, right? And where this is not true, where plus gets mapped to something that is not commutative. That's the idea. Right? I know it's a bit odd. And I've done this in the past. So anyway, just digressing a little bit, right? What it's saying is that whenever I write something, I need to give it meaning. If you're implicitly giving it the meaning that you know about, that plus maps to the notion of addition, then you've already given something semantics, right? You're already doing that. What I'm saying is that, you know, the fact that I've written this as x plus y plus x doesn't necessarily mean that it's addition. It could be whatever. Once, it's only when I give it meaning that it has meaning. I give it semantics that it has meaning, right? So an atomic formula, let's carry on, an atomic formula of the form predicate term 1 to term n is true, right? If and only if the objects referred to by term 1 to term n are in the relation referred to by the predicate, right? Which is, okay, so I've given meaning to the predicate already, then I have to check that this relation actually holds, right? Any questions about this? No? Okay, good. So here's one example. For instance, this is just our example. So just to show that, for instance, so these are our objects there, they are constants. So these are the objects of our domain, Richard and John. So what we can do, we can have like a sort of unary predicate that's going to be like, this is a person, for instance, and you can have binary relations. They're brothers, for instance. And you can have the notion of like a crown, whether something is a crown or not. That's a unary one as well. And whether it's on the head of somebody or not. And the function is going to return something, right? It's going to say, give me the left leg, things like that, right? And this is a person, this is a king. See, beautifully drawn. Either Russell or Novick, one of the two, is really an artist. This one is really unhappy. Rich and the nine. Of course, so you can tell, like, right, he's the bad guy, right? No, he's not. Why is he unhappy? He's got all the money. Do you know anything about Richard the Lionheart and King John? No? You know about Robin Hood, surely. Just go from there. Anyway, let's carry on. Yeah, right, so that's funny, right? Already, just talking about this, we can give this actual meaning why they like, you know, if we know what this refers to. Otherwise, it's just some random R and some random J. Right, but if you know about the story of the bad king, etc., then it actually means something more. Okay, we talk about the universal quantifiers. So usually it's going to be of the form for all, where you're going to have some variables and a formula, right? So we'll often write it like this. So even though already it sort of says variables there, so really it should have been just probably variables. So we usually write it like this: for all x, y, comma y, p. So sometimes people don't put the comma, right? P means for all x, for all y. Well, with a P there, which is missing. Huh. But yeah, so usually when you write it like this, it enables you to give a shortcut instead of writing each of the for all separately. Right? So that's all I'm trying to say here. So here's an example. Everyone at the University of Edinburgh is smart. For all x, at x, University of Edinburgh is something there, implies smart x. Right? Of course, is this true? Is it? I don't know. Well, of course, you know, that's the thing, right? Is it true? It all depends what syntax, what semantic you give to this, right? Maybe at is like somebody attending course here and smart maps to stupid. Then is it true? I don't know. Anyway, but this gives us a way of writing something in that form. So this is sort of capturing, if we sort of say this is the semantics, everyone at the University of Edinburgh is smart, that's the way we might capture it, right? So then it means for all XP is true, if there is an interpretation M, right, there's a model for it, why, with x being each possible object in the interpretation. So for us to be able to do this, we'd have to go through everybody who's at the University of Edinburgh and find a way of deciding whether they're smart or not.
probably fail, start with me, will fail immediately. It's easy. So then you can negate this very quickly. So as soon as you find somebody who's not smart, that's it, right? But what is the problem with this? That's all very nice to say. What is the general issue? Well, too many people, yeah, but you can still do it, right? The problem is,
The definition of smart.
Well, that's one other issue. Let's assume we know what smart is. Somehow, whatever it is, can all solve a particular problem, that's smart. But what is the other problem? I mean, maybe not generally for this one. What is the general idea? What is the general problem with this in terms of saying, you know, I can tell you what it means to say that this is true, but the problem is that your domain could be, your domain could be infinitely large. Then how do you do that? So when it comes to a semantic way of doing this, basically, you're doomed, right? There's no way if it's an infinite domain that you can test, right? So then you need to have something, that's why you need to have a notion of proof, right? So when we know about this, so that's why people can rely on sorts of things to do with prime factorization and all these kind of things, because you just need to keep doing testing. There's been no proof of particular things. So if not been proven, you can keep going forever, right? So roughly speaking, just to give you another bit of kind of informal way of looking at this, it is equivalent to the conjunctions of instantiations of P, right? So all the possibilities, even those that don't seem to make sense. So really, if I have this, I just go for all the possibilities in the domain for x, and I just keep going and I just substitute for x for all of them. Of course, look at this one, right? It may look weird, but it's perfectly legal to write it like this, unless you have a way of distinguishing between that University of Edinburgh belongs to a particular domain and a person belongs to a different domain. If not, you can write something. If University of Edinburgh is at your University of Edinburgh, then University of Edinburgh is smart, right? You happy with this? So the idea is that you have to test it against each of the elements in the domain, and if it's an infinite domain, that's never going to finish as a test. Right, and one thing that I should mention is a common mistake, and I'll say this today, and in the tutorial, I'm sure it will still happen. Typically, implication is the main connective with for all. Typically, most of the time when you have a for all, right? And the common mistake is that people use an and instead with that. I'm not saying it's always the case, but most of the time it is the case. So if you had to say, we had this sentence, right? Everyone at the University of Edinburgh is smart, and we wrote it like this. For all x, at x, University of Edinburgh, n small x, that's not saying what we wanted to say. Because this actually means everybody is at the University of Edinburgh and everybody is smart, right? This is saying everyone is there for all x. Anybody I can pick is going to be this is going to be true and this is going to be true. And definitely this one is easier to show it's false, right? Just pick somebody outside random, well, not randomly. Further away you get from the university, probably easier it gets. But right, so everyone at the University of Edinburgh is at the University of Edinburgh, and everyone's smart. That's what an N would be there. Okay. So then we can look at existential quantification. Very similar. Well, very similar, but not the same. But the idea is there in terms of the syntax. We can write like this: the existence x y p for the existence y x, the existence y p. So the p is there for this one. I should put the p there, right? So that's missing. Yep. Oops. Too fast. And the existence P is true is an interpretation M, if and only if P is true, with X being some possible object in the model. Is this one easier than the previous one? Well, yes, no. Is it? Why?
If you find one, then that's okay, but again, never know when you finish searching.
So it's not easier. Yeah, because if your domain is infinite, as long as I haven't found one, doesn't mean there isn't one, right? This is looking for a witness. Maybe it's even harder, because hopefully the other one you can fail early, because you find someone who doesn't satisfy it. But this one is saying, keep looking, right? Search for extraterrestrial, anyone, things like that. Just because we haven't found one doesn't mean there isn't one, right? So what do you believe? Do you think there are aliens out there? They are, right? Can't be. Hmm?
Men.
Eh? Men.
Men.
Who?
What?
Doesn't matter. Do you think aliens have visited Earth?
No.
Come on.
I see them all the time.
You see them all the time? Yeah, I know. I mean, the way you guys look at me sometimes, I'm the alien here, for sure. Oh, God. Yes. Yeah, I'm sure they are. So, what this means, roughly speaking, is equivalent to the disjunction in this case, right? It's just saying, find me one instance of this. where you know, I substitute for x in there, and it's actually true. So this, so there's the or there, right? So you're looking for a witness in this case, right? That's going to make it true. But it's equally hard because if your domain is infinite, you can keep going, right? And never stop, okay? So here's the opposite mistake that people, well, the similar but opposite, I don't know how to say this. It's like very, very similar. Except that it's like the dual, right? That's what I should say. So another common mistake is typically to say n is going to be, conjunction is going to go with existential. And the common mistake is to use implication with this as the main connective. So if I add this, there exists an x, add the x u of e implies small x. Well, this is going to be true if there is anyone who's not at the University of Edinburgh, right? I just pick somebody who's not. That's false. False implies whatever is true, right? Bear that in mind. So if you are slightly worried, you're trying to do the translation, you've been given something in English, you have to translate it, just do a quick check when you've written it, just to exactly that kind of test, right? Just say, you know, if this is false, does it make immediately the whole sentence true? I don't have to care about the conclusion. And if it does, you probably got it wrong, right? Well, not necessarily, but probably, okay? So, and once we're happy, generally happy about this, we can look quickly at some properties of these quantifiers. So we don't care about this. We can basically permute them if they are all the same. So if you have for all x, for all y, we can just change the order. And it's the same, there exists an x, there exists a y. So this extends to having n quantifiers of the same type, right? So if they are all the same, we don't care. We can just change the order. It doesn't matter, right? But if we have what's known as alternating quantifiers, one is an extension and one's a for all, or vice versa, then they're not. You can't just change the order, right? And this is easy because we can have a very simple example there. If I have this, it says there exists an x for all y such that x loves y. This really means, you know, if you give it some semantics, is that there is a person who loves everyone in the world. Yeah, there is. So there is someone who loves everybody, right? Whereas this one is saying for all y, there exists an x loves x, y. So this one is saying pick anybody, right? Right? Anybody, pick anybody, any y. That person is going to be loved by at least one person. There is going to be someone who's going to love y, right? Happy with this? No? So he's saying for all y, for anyone, everyone in the world is loved by at least one person, or is loved by, yeah, at least one. There could be more, right? There will be at least one person who loves y. Okay? Pretty good, right? It's pretty positive. Nobody can say they're unloved. And this one doesn't exist. There's no one who loves everybody in the world. Dalai Lama? Oh, no. maybe not. Anyway.
Who? Me? No. You?
God.
But God is God in the world. God.
Notice the air quotes.
Yeah, the air quotes.
Yeah. God. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but is God in the world? That's the question.
He's everywhere.
He is, right? By definition, he has to be in the world too.
Or is he a she?
Yeah. Don't be.
Oh, okay.
Don't be ridiculous. Okay, so there is someone who loves everybody. So the important thing is that you realize these are not the same, right? So you can't just willy-nilly just change the order of quantifiers which are not the same. Right? So, and it's easy because you can actually have this notion of duality here. So really, you don't need two quantifiers because you just need one and you can define the other in terms of the other. Right? So for instance, I can say for all x lies at X likes ice cream, everybody likes ice cream. So that, what does this mean? This is not the case that there is an X such that X not likes X ice cream, right? Of course, you know, it's much nicer to have something like this as opposed to writing things in negated form all the time, right? We all know once you start having negation, double negation, how things get quite confused and quite difficult to understand, right? But what this is trying to say is that really you only need one quantifier. And then you define the other in terms of that one, right? You only need for all and you define exist in terms of it, or you only need existential and you can define for all in terms of it. So there exists someone who likes broccoli. It means it is not the case for anyone that I pick, everybody doesn't like broccoli. There is someone. Okay, there exists an X. So, right, happy with this? Good. And equality itself, right, it's the usual notion. Term 1 is equal to term 2 is true, right? And they're given interpretation. If and only if term 1 and term 2 refer to the same object. So it's what you would expect. 2 is equal to 2. Uh-huh. But of course, things get more complicated. Is 2 equal to 2? Is 4 equal to 2 plus 2? It depends on plus, exactly. What interpretation you give to plus. If you make plus, well, maybe you should do this. Is 6 equal to 3 plus 3? And you decide your interpretation of plus is multiplication, definitely it's not true.
Good.
So, and what we can do, once we have all these, we can start defining. So even sibling doesn't have to be, can be defined, so we can have an equivalence there. So this is like saying, you know, what is the notion of sibling like? What does it mean to be a sibling, right? So for all x, y, x is a sibling of y, if and only if x and y are distinct, right? Then you have an m and an f. So basically we're saying we have a mother and a father, right? And they're not the same, right, somehow. So we need this right now. And the parent of m and the parent of x, m is the parent of x, and f is the parent of x, and m is the parent of y, and f is the parent of y. So basically they have the same parents, x and y, right? So that's one way of defining the notion of sibling, okay? But note, this is important, right, that they are also not the same. You don't want to define just like siblings, just anybody is a sibling of himself or herself. You want to have at least, so this means if you're talking about this, all right, here's an idea. So if I'm going to give this some kind of domain, what does this mean about the domain? How many objects does the domain has to have at least for this to be true? Is it 4? This, well, for it to be true? Well, that's interesting, right? It all depends on, okay, let's assume the usual notion of parent and all this, yeah. At least 4. Of course, nothing says that M is not X and F is not Y, etc. in there. That would be a bit odd, but hey. Unless you have a time machine, of course, right? Then you can be, you can be your own grandparent. Yeah. Ever watched this episode of Futurama where Fry goes into the future and kills his grandfather? Is it his grandfather he kills? Or is it his great-great-great-great-grandfather? Somebody far away. But of course, you've all seen Back to the Future. Exactly. You need to go very far. Anyway. How did we get there? I don't even know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're talking about somebody being his own parent. Right, but this, what this means that your domain, for this sentence to be true, your domain has to have at least, probably at least 2, but in more, all likelihood, at least 4 objects for you to be able to actually make it true. Okay? So, how do we use this? Now we can talk about our notion of kinship domain that we had before with brothers and all this. So we can say things like this. Well, brothers or sibling, you know, the kinship. Well, for all x, y, if x is a brother of y, then they're siblings, right? Sibling x, y. One's mother is one's female parent, generally, usually. So for all m, mother of c, so this we can use a function then that's going to return the mother of c. If the mother of C is equal to M, then it, if and only if M is female and M is the parent of C. Yeah? And also is the what we saw before as a particular instance, sibling itself is symmetric, right? For all XY, sibling XY, if and only if sibling YX. So we can start writing all these kind of things. So basically we can now come up with a language. It's strong enough that we can start talking more generally about X and Y without having to refer to definite constants in our domain, right? We don't have to now talk about you, and write a sentence for each one of you, whether you're brothers or sisters, and things like that, right? So we can just talk more generally. And here's one, I'm not going to go for it, but this can enable you, for instance, to characterize what it means for something to be a set, for instance, right? S is a set, if and only if. So we're basically defining this predicate set here. Either S is empty, or there exists an X and S2, such that S2 is a set, and S is equal to X inserted into the set S2. That's one way of looking at it, right? Yeah. Oh, what can you tell me about this definition? It's a definition, but it's always, no, really, it's recursive, right? Because you have to assume that, you know, you can insert a new element in there. So in a way, it's not complete even. Yeah. You should be able to say, you know, otherwise, you need to say that X is actually a new element that's not already in S2. So it's not actually fully there. But anyway, that's the idea. Look at this. The thing that's slightly is that set appears on both sides. So you add something to a set, and S is also a set there. It's either empty or it's something that you get by adding some element to an existing set. Right? Yeah, that will work. You don't need to say that it's not the same. That's fine. So, and also you can have something like this. It's not the case that a set containing at least one element is going to be the empty set, right? So you just have to have distinguish the empty set from all the other sets, for instance, et cetera, et cetera. Some of these you may have seen already. Two sets are equal if either is a subset of each other, right? Oh, yeah. Now that I look at this, what's missing from this? You probably should have something that also says we're talking about sets there. This is from Russell and Olving. Because otherwise, we're just saying S1 is equal to S2. But it's not saying that we're talking about the notion that this, we're not saying like set S1 and set S2 implies this if and only if this. I'll double check this, actually. Okay. Don't worry. So you don't need to, you don't need to memorize this, right, by the way, obviously, just to give you some idea. So, okay, now how do we go about talking about our one-plus world in a bit more kind of succinct fashion now that we have first-order logic? Well, suppose we have the one-plus world agent, and it's using a first-order logic KB, and perceives a smell and a breeze, but no glitter at t=5. So we're going to also introduce a data structure that we can have, which is a list, right? So this is perfectly definable in first-order logic, right? It's very similar. You can have a theory which makes it look very similar to the axioms, the things that we had for set there, right? And okay, so how do we do this? It becomes this idea. Remember we had the tell and the asking? No? Yes? No? Do you? You don't, do you? You can tell something to the database, and then you can ask him something, right, or the knowledge base. So what we can say is that, for instance, tell the KB that there is the percept at time t=5 is that there's a smell, there's a breeze. So let's assume there's a list there. The first one is about smell. The second position element is breeze. The third one is for glitter. Right? So you could say, well, at time 5, the percept was smell, breeze, and no glitter. Right? Could have been no or none. It's fine. Then what we do is to ask the knowledge base later on something to decide what to do. Right? So ask the knowledge base, give me, is there exists an A, best action of A at t=5? So what's going to happen in this case, right, the KB is going to hopefully entail some best action at time t5, right, t=5. So it's going to basically say, okay, yes, for instance, right, and the action is shoot. So this is the notion of substitution. So we're going to look at this in more detail when we look at unification, right? So what we can do now is that we can have some way of saying, you know, tell me what would be the best action by, you know, at time 5. And we can write this in first order logic. Because I'm just saying there exists an A, which is the best action at t=5. I don't know what A is. Hopefully you will substitute, you will replace this A by a value. Right? So this is what you do in prologue and things like that. Right? And given a sentence S and a substitution sigma, S sigma is going to denote the result of basically plugging sigma into S. Right? So if you have something like this, this is my S, X, Y, and I decide X is going to be Obama and Y is going to be Palin. So I do S of sigma, I just do the substitution that Obama is smarter than Palin, right? Is this true?
Yeah, more or less.
Rumor has it. Rumor has it? Yeah. Rumor has it. Hey, where is Palin, by the way? Where is she? She's busy. She's made a lot of money. She doesn't have to do anything. Right, so then the idea is that when you ask the KB, right, like we've seen before, it's going then to return you some or all sigma. So it's going to give you all the possible answers such that the KB entails this, right, with the substitution applied to S. You happy with this? So you want to find whatever is entailed by the KB, so there could be more than one solution. Maybe, you know, what is the best action? Maybe there's more than one. They're all equally good. One is shoot, the other one is leg it, right, or whatever. Okay? So that's just to give you an idea. And then what we can do is that we can express things that we had before in a nice way. So we can say, for instance, the notion of perception can be expressed nicely now, right? So for all t, for at any time, whether there's a smell or not there, whether there's a breeze or not there, if there is glitter there that's perceived, this means at time t I can say there was glitter, right? So if that's a percept that's made there at this time, means that at time t glitter was true, there was something glittering, right? And we can have the notion of a reflex, right, by saying, if you detect glitter, do something, right? So at any time, if something is glittering, the best action is to try to do a grab action. That's all that he's saying. So now you no longer have to say, if it's at time t1, time 2, time 3, whatever. You just say, at any time, if this is the thing that you have, right? The best action is to do a grab. Copy this? And you can write things in a more kind of succinct way without having to specify all possible time. Okay? And we can write other things now more succinctly as well for the notion of adjacency, for instance, right? So we can write it like that, x for all x, y, a, b, right? If x is adjacent to y, x, y, so these are the coordinates. If x, y is adjacent to a, b, well, what does it mean? This is if and only if the pair a, b, right, you see, right, it's going to be either one of these. It's going to belong to the set where it's this, that, or that, right? So I could have used pairs there instead of lists. What else could I have? You know, what is another way of writing this which is less succinct? Adjacent x, y to a, b. If I didn't have list or pairs, how would I write this down? I would say, what would I say? What would be all the cases? How would I write this?
X equals a plus 1 or...
Yes, exactly. So you would have A equals x plus 1 and B equals y. Or, the second one, or, so you have like four disjunctions, right? Four disjuncts. So you would have A is equal to... And what is it? X minus 1, right? And y is equal to, b is equal to y, et cetera, et cetera. So then you would have another one. Or, so this is just a succinct way of saying of writing four disjunctions, right? OK? You happy with this? So I'd rather write it like this. But when it comes to proofs, unless you know how to, you have something to enable you to reason with sets, things would eventually might boil down to just doing reasoning with disjunctions. This means like a four-way case split. That's not very nice, right? So I could say something like this: if agent S, for all S and T, right? If agent, what does this mean? So if the agent is at position S at time t, and there's a breeze there at this time that's perceived, right? So then this means that this square is breezy. Whatever, I can write whatever I want, right? Until I can characterize what's going on. But what this means is that then we can have these two things which are quite interesting, because we have the notion of a diagnostic and the notion of a diagnostic rule or something which is like a causal rule. So a diagnostic rule is one that's going to try to infer the cause from the effect, right? For all S, if S is breezy, this implies that there exists something which is adjacent to it, right? There exists an adjacent square such that there's a pit in that square, right? There exists this. So where do you have these kind of rules, right? So these are the ones that are usually used by doctors, right? If you go to the doctor, you say, I have a pain in the stomach, they're going to say, okay, this is trying to make a diagnostic. You try to figure out what's going on. What could be what could be causing this, the cause from the effect? And this one is to infer the effect from the cause. It says, if there is a pit, well, right, for anything that's a pit, then all squares that are adjacent to it are going to be breezy, right? Remember when you're doing like deduction, you're going forward, you're trying to say, okay, if there is something, you infer the effect from the cause. And they work differently, right? One is like, one is trying to decide, what is it that may be causing something? The other one is trying to tell you, if you have this, this is what's happening. Okay, so Sherlock Holmes, what sort of reasoning does he do? Deduction. So is it diagnostic or causal? Generally, a detective. Think about it. So what do they do? What do they see usually? They see the effect, right? The blood is there, but the body is there. How could that have happened? exactly. Oh, actually, so the example of Cluedo that you have is one of those, right? In the assignment. Who killed whom and where? Exactly. Here's a summary there. So first of the logic, we have the notion of objects and relations, and they are semantic primitives, right? So the syntax is more expressive than propositional logic, obviously, right? And you have constants, functions, predicates. Equality, but not always. We've decided to include equality as a basic thing, but you don't necessarily have to have this. And we have our quantifiers, right? It has an increased expressive power, which is sufficient to define the Wampus world much more concisely. And but what happens now is that you're going to need to have to do, you need proof procedures to be able to actually do things and reason about it. So resolution is one thing that we can use, or we're going to see modus ponens or generalized modus ponens. Any questions? You all happy with this? More or less up to date with first order logic if you couldn't remember anything? Yeah? Sure? You guys always say yes to everything I say. And then when you're moving out, I hear you whispering, I had understood nothing about this lecture. All right, thanks very much. So lecture on Tuesday is about the assignment, right? So please come, because there will be some helpful things going on there if you haven't started looking at it, right? And because I'm so nice and so kind, on Thursday there'll be a lecture which is just a bit about Haskell. And if you can't remember your Haskell, come to that as well, because we're going to use the data types, the various things that are actually related to the assignment to explain things. And all, and you can, if you have questions, you can ask these. So it's not going to be just some random lecture about Haskell, something which is a bit more focused. And remember, the assignment itself is not about learning Haskell. You're supposed to know about this already, right? Hey? All right, thanks very much. Have a good weekend. See you next week.
Objects in the domain, so like for example, in natural language, you don't have one side of functions or predicates. So that's higher order logic. Yes, yeah, so that would be a good thing to mention actually. That's what makes a difference. You're not allowed to say for all functions, this function is like going to be always greater than this other function. So that's where you start to move to higher order logic. Right? Yep. Yes.
I'm not sure whether you basically, before you start encrypting it, whether you have made all possible. You would have Miss Scarlet in the great house, in the kitchen, or whether you just have all the available sort of, like, you don't have a sort of, it's not modeled, it's not mapped to anything, you just sort of construct from there, or whether you do take all possible items and then make them.
Oh, no, but if you're doing the whole kind of idea of constraint satisfaction that you assign and you go along, right? So yeah, you assign that because you build your model as you go along, right? So that's the idea, because you do the assignment, because otherwise it defeats the purpose. If you're going to enumerate everything, it's truth table, right?
Well,
it's going to be very slow.
It's like, obviously, the Australian one with the map, obviously we just started at one and just went through it.
Yeah.
That's where you're suggesting.
That's the way,
The way where you had the arcs over it, it looked like you just assigned all the colors.
No. What this was showing were the possible values. Okay, it's slightly misleading. It's what it's telling you is that these are the possibilities that you have. Right. Like, I see what you mean, because when you have red, blue, and green,
yeah,
that's it. No.
I thought you were wrong.
No, it's telling these are still the possibilities. These are the possible.
You take one at a time.
That's right. Because what you're going to do is that this is you're going to change the state as you go along. You do one. Because you've done it all already, what do you do? How do you work with that?
Yeah,
it is ambiguous. It's not clear that this is what it is, right? It's like